Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, May 23rd, 2022, and I'm the host of the show, Cara Santa Maria. And of course, before we dive into this week's episode, I do want to thank those of you who make Talk Nerdy possible each and every week. Remember, Talk Nerdy is and will always be 100% free to download. And that's because I rely on the support of individuals just like you to keep this train on the tracks. I want to give a big shout out to my top patrons this week. They include Daniel Lang, David J.E. Smith, Mary Neva, Brian Holden, Dudas Infinitas, Gabriel F. Jaramillo Gonzalez, June Sapara, Leonard Prince, Pasquale Gelati, and Ulrika Hagman, and of course, hundreds of others who support the show on an per-episode basis. So if you're interested in pledging your support, all you got to do is visit patreon.com/talknerdy. You can also support the show in a lot of different ways. You can buy merch. You can go to talknerdymerch.com and see all the cool stuff, all the swag that's available for sale there. And you can also just rate, review on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, share on social media, get people excited about the show and listening, because more downloads always equals more ad revenue. Which is the other way the train stays on the tracks. All right, let's dive into this week's episode. So I had the awesome opportunity to chat with Dr. Elsa Panciaroli. She is a paleontologist. She studies the evolution and ecology of extinct animals. And right now she does her research at the University of Oxford and the National Museums of Scotland. She also, over in the UK, does an awful lot of incredible science communication. She gives a lot of talks and contributes to different outlets like The Guardian and Biological Sciences Review. She's got a new book out, and it's such an interesting and important one. It's called Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution. So we're going to take a little trip down our long memory lane, our evolutionary memory lane, and understand really kind of where we come from and what kind of misunderstandings, misconceptions we have about mammalian evolution. So without any further ado, here she is, Dr. Elsa Panciaroli. Elsa, thank you so much for joining me today.
Hi, Cara. I'm so excited to be here.
Me too. So I know that there have been some schedules and reschedules, and I'm so glad that we're able to finally kind of come together to talk about not just your new book, but your newer new book. So the first book is Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution. And this book is available right now. So as you're listening to this show, you can also be queuing up wherever you buy your books, and you can add that to your cart. But you also have a new book coming up called The Earth, Biography of Life, The Story of Life on Our Planet Through 50 Creatures. So I guess I should ask, and that's the American title, it looks like. It's slightly different, I think, for the UK title, 47 Incredible Organisms. I love that. I always love to see the slight differences. So I guess maybe the question that's first on my mind is, as a paleontologist and as somebody who is quite interested in modern mammals and their origins, are the 50 or 47 incredible creatures or organisms all mammals? Are they along the mammal lineage? Is there a convergence there?
Oh, well, I mean, I have to admit there are some mammals and mammal predecessors in there, but I did my best not to do that, even though I could easily pick 50 amazing mammals and their ancestors. But I didn't need to, because they're in the first book, Beasts Before Us. So no, I managed to avoid. So the second one is very much more spread across the tree of life. There's everything from single-celled organisms to fungi, trees, every different type of organism.
Oh, I love that, because I do think that sometimes we obviously do have a mammalian bias, because we are mammals. Mm-hmm. And of course, we often, when we think of life, we think of animals. And when we think of animals, we think of fuzzy animals. And so it's always nice to see these sort of overlooked creatures have their due. And not even creatures per se, but I guess bacteria is a creature. Is a bacterium a creature?
I guess we don't really use the word creature in science. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. You're so right. That has no scientific meaning whatsoever. But it does seem to evoke a meaning that is linked to something that moves. You know, like I don't know if I would see a plant and think creature, although maybe it is. And I definitely don't know if like a sea sponge or something like that, although they do move, just not perceptibly to us. It is funny that there is the colloquial way that we have these conversations about life around us. And then there's the strict scientific way. I remember visiting the Amazon and somebody telling us, you know, you hear this word jungle all the time. The word jungle has no scientific basis. Like, you're in a rainforest right now. And actually, jungle is kind of racist and colonial and has like some pretty problematic origins.
It really does. Yeah. And I think certainly as you know, when you're becoming a scientist, you are steadily being trained to use much more precise language, which is why so often scientists eventually get to the point where they can't talk like normal people, because they've been trained not to use these kinds of words that everybody recognizes, because they have to be more specific. And yeah, so this is why the in my book, it's organisms, so that, you know, it's living things, but organisms basically covers everything that's alive. So that's why I've used that word.
Absolutely. And I can imagine that, you know, you're not, I shouldn't say you're not just a scientist, as if that's not enough, but you are a paleontologist who also does a lot of science communication, which, you know, I think is incredibly important. It's near and dear to my heart. It's, you know, something that I've dedicated a lot of my life to. And oh gosh, I remember there was a quote that I came across recently. Maybe it was on the other show that I do. And so I don't know who to attribute it to, but it was something like, science is not finished until it's communicated. Sort of, otherwise it's in a vacuum, right? And you've been working to communicate science for quite some time. And of course, that is what a trade book is so good at doing, is taking the work that you do in the lab, in the field, you know, in the kind of academic spheres, and translating it, making it accessible, and adding the story component that makes it real, so that we, the kind of audience, can appreciate that.
Yeah, work. I mean, I really like telling people about stuff, and particularly, you know, because I come from, you know, a pretty regular background, and I'm learning all these as I've gone through a PhD and everything. You'll know, I'm sure you'll know the same thing. You get this sort of urge. You want to tell people about what you do. But as you get sort of further on, it becomes harder and harder to communicate the sort of more niche things that you're beginning to be taught. But you know, particularly as a paleontologist, you start to learn all these things that really overturn narratives that you've had since you were little, you know. So this is what this book, Beast Before Us, is really based on, is as I went through the process of becoming a trained scientist, I started to be told the kind of real story behind an awful lot of different animal groups, and realized that a lot of the stuff that we are sort of told generally by, particularly by the media, but also by movies, by books, is quite often very wrong. Or is just framed in a way that is not quite right. And this is what I really wanted to do with it, was to say to everyone, oh my goodness, you're not going to believe what I've just found out about mammals. It's incredible. So the book's subtitle is The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution, because it is the bit that you actually don't hear about. And to my knowledge, there is no other popular science book that has told this portion of the story. They usually focus on, well, let's start a different way. When I say to people, I study the origin of mammals, generally, they assume that I'm talking about the point from 66 million years ago, you know, when the asteroid hit the planet and the non-bird dinosaurs were wiped out. That, you know, that's the time that people usually assume mammals get their start. And that, you know, and if they existed before that time, that they weren't really doing anything. It was all just dinosaurs. And one of the things that really stunned me as I was a student and began learning about this, was that that's not the start at all. That's nowhere near the start. The last 66 million years is a tiny fraction. The story of where mammals come from actually goes back more than 200 million years before that. And they were doing lots of really interesting, exciting things, not only during the time of dinosaurs, but in fact, when it comes to the sort of fundamental beginnings of backboned animals, it was the ancestors of mammals that did the best stuff first. They grew large, they became mega herbivores and carnivores, and they were doing all this incredible stuff on our planet when reptiles really weren't doing as much. And people just don't hear about these stories. So this is what I wanted to focus on in this book, this sort of untold part of the narrative.
Oh, I love that. You would be pleased to know that when I was working on my master's degree, my professor, Dr. Gunter Gross, who taught neurophysiology, he would always say, 250 years of, or 250 million years of mammalian evolution has not let us down. Like, you would always that number. So you'd be pleased to say to know that he was thinking
That's
back
super.
That far.
Yeah, sure. I'm really glad to hear that.
That's so funny. It's the only thing. It, like, it triggered this very, very kind of stark memory when you said that. And it's true. I mean, so much of this, I shouldn't say so much of this, but so much of science is categorizing. So much of it is taxonomy. So much of it is putting things into buckets and making timelines and deciding on these somewhat arbitrary but mutually agreed upon thresholds and cutoffs and boundaries. And if you think about it, I mean, the origin of who I am right now came back to the very first.
Oh, yeah.
Organism on the planet. You know, like, mammalian evolution goes back to the same starting point as all life. And so it's so interesting that, yeah, we have arbitrarily kind of said, oh, when the dinosaurs died, that's when the mammals kind of ruled, and anything that happened before that was incidental. Because, yeah, you've got to keep going back, and there's always more story to tell.
Absolutely. And I mean, obviously, as you point out, this book, if I really want to go back to the beginning, I could go right back to the first, you know, cellular life, you know, like 4 billion years ago. But I take it from the point where the common ancestor of the animals that would eventually include reptiles and the animals that would eventually include mammals, where they split. And that's another sort of fundamental misconception that people have, that mammals evolve from reptiles. But actually, reptiles and mammals both evolved from something that was neither. It was this other thing, this backboned, four-limbed creature that was the predecessor of both groups. So I figured that was a sort of logical starting point, because that's really, I think I say in the book, that's kind of where we hit the mammal highway. Like, from there on, it's all creatures that are more closely related to us than they are to any reptile.
You know, it's funny because, so I took a paleontology class when I was in undergrad in college. So it was, you know, a while ago now, but not ancient history. I want to say this would have been maybe 2002 that I would have been in this paleontology course. And I think I've mentioned this on air before, but I was at a community college for the first couple of years before I started at my four-year school. And it was such a great class, but it was literally listed in the course guide, not as paleontology, it was listed as dinosaurs in all capital letters with an exclamation point after it. That's how it was, like, the course description. And so it was very dinosaur heavy. But I remember learning very specifically about like Dimetrodon, and it being called a mammal-like reptile. That's how they referred to this organism and its lineage. And when I think back to sort of pre-mammalian, kind of same common ancestor as reptiles, and those early splits where you're like, it didn't quite look like what we consider to be a mammal, but it was still mammalian-ish, I think of Dimetrodon. But do you think it's a misnomer for them to have called it back then a mammal-like reptile?
So, when that term was coined, people did think that mammals came from reptiles.
I see.
And I mean, really, it's sort of born from looking of the stance that we take looking at history and looking at evolution is, obviously, we stand here in the present and we look backwards. And so we look back and we look at things and say, that looks like a reptile, which is the animal that we now know that's alive today. But really, that's actually back to front. We should be naming things, thinking about what came before, rather than what came after. So, of course, they looked back and they thought these creatures look like reptiles, therefore mammals must have come from reptiles. When actually it would be more accurate, you know, the real reason they look like reptiles is just because some reptiles have retained some of these very early features that the ancestors of both mammals and reptiles shared. So looking at it now from our perspective, we think they all look like reptiles back then, but actually it's just that reptiles still look like the creatures that they evolved from and that mammals also evolved from, which were, of course, not reptiles. They were something slightly different. So, yeah, it's a kind of just trying to get your head around looking at it in a different perspective.
Yeah, sort of looking forward from the past as opposed to looking backward from the present.
Exactly.
We think of so I mentioned Dimetrodon because it's one of these, like, it frustrates me whenever I'm in old museums or when I see like children's drawings or bed sheets or t-shirts and they say dinosaurs and then there's always a picture of Dimetrodon. Oh, I'm like, it's not a dinosaur. You know, and I think it's because it has that sail on its back, which evokes this visceral image. But exactly what you're saying, the analogy that I think of is if we, you know, without some of the modern tools of science that we have, had looked at a bat and go, obviously a bird, you know, and then just like threw it into that lineage, not having the tools that we now have to say, no, this is a weird situation where this like mammal happened to evolve flight. Because looking backward, it reminds us, like, especially if bats, let's say, were extinct and we're only looking at the fossil record,
it might have reminded us of
you know, our only kind of contemporary comparison. And
exactly.
That's how we slotted these things in.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. And certainly Dimetrodon is a lot of people, you know, well, that's a touchstone. A lot of people will recognize it. So as you say, it's that creature that sort of superficially is reconstructed a bit like a Komodo dragon with a sail in its back. I talk about it in a lot of depth in the book because, of course, people are so interested in it. And it is one of these creatures that was lumped in with these so-called mammal-like reptiles. I do go on a slight tirade in the book about how we need to kill that term, though, because I think...
Agree.
Yeah.
Because it stuck with me because I learned it back then. And then, you know, it's like I learned it in an academic setting and then it just doesn't really come up in everyday life. So nothing replaced that knowledge for me.
Exactly. And that's the thing. And so the book, of course, is about science, but it's also about language. It's also about how we talk about evolution and how we talk, in this case, particularly about the mammal lineage, which as a whole is called Synapsida, how we talk about them, but also how we use language in general to talk about evolution. So I argue in this, and many people who research these animals agree, that we should try not to use the term mammal-like reptile because it just makes it sound like mammals come from reptiles and that eventually they get more mammal-like and then they're mammals, which is actually just factually incorrect. But as you say, if people are not encountering the facts all the time, then they just hear the term and it perpetuates.
Yeah.
But, sorry, go on.
How would you refer to Dimetrodon now, just as an early synapsid, or where in the sort of, I know this is like, we're not starting at the beginning or the end, I just picked a random species in the middle, but what do you think is the most appropriate way to sort of categorize Dimetrodon now?
Yeah, a synapsid, an early synapsid. So people would call them early synapsids, and this is another slight issue, is that obviously if you don't use these touchstone terms like mammal-like reptile, you do have to learn some new terms. And the book has quite a few terms that maybe won't be familiar to people. So there's the early synapsids, then there's a group called the therapsids, then there's the cynodonts, then there's the mammals. And some people have said to me that, you know, they find it difficult with the terminology. But the reason we find it difficult is just because we're so used to hearing about dinosaurs. And if you think about it, we actually commonly know lots and lots and lots of dinosaur terminology because we hear it all the time. So if we were to start using these terms more often, we will eventually get to the point where it's not so foreign to us to hear the word synapsid. It would become more recognizable. But, you know, we have to just keep using it and doing things like, you know, if a newspaper does use the term mammal-like reptiles, I will occasionally just send a message and say, loved your article, but it would be great if in the future you could avoid that term because it's actually not correct, to try and get rid of them, these terminologies, to try and help people generally just understand how our understanding of evolution has moved on.
Yeah. And I, what I love and I think is so important for reading your book is the genius of including this sort of lineage, this history. I don't know, is this it's not a cladogram, is it? I never remember what the difference in those terms are.
Is this in the sort of in the cover, the
yeah,
the
in
diagram?
The sort of cover of the book. You've got one at the beginning and one at the end, which really helps you orient your mind and remember these touchstone terms and exactly kind of where they fall on the origin of mammals.
Yeah, we tried to keep it really nice and simple, just as you say, to give people a touchstone as they follow the story through, because it is told, I hope, in a sort of engaging story-like way. And it's linear. I'm taking you from the past through time. But you know, actually, a lot of these terms, they're nested within one another like Russian dolls. So actually, we, of course, are also synapsids because we're part of this group. But generally, of course, we wouldn't refer to ourselves as that. We just, it's a taxonomic thing.
We sort of take whatever the most recent split or the most recent evolutionary kind of arbitrary point is.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
That's you refer to something that's extant, right? But if you go back, it's true. Like I'm looking at Dimetrodon and I'm seeing that after the, you know, a synapsid split, like is an early synapsid. And then there's more things that happen in time afterward. So Dimetrodon doesn't fall under those terms. It's like, what's the most recent in the past that still explains, I guess, their place? But gosh, it's confusing, isn't it?
It's difficult to sometimes get your head around these things. But I mean, really reading this book, I hope one of the core messages is that although these things, we've been reconstructing them in artworks and things as if they are all reptile-like creatures. But actually, there's a lot of evidence to suggest that right back at the very, very beginning, so Dimetrodon, you're looking at, you know, around about the 300 million years ago mark or just thereafter, these creatures, some of them were already having things like elevated metabolism. So they were more warm-blooded, you know, more like a mammal and fast-moving. They're not all sluggish creatures dragging themselves through swamps, that they're dynamic and they're very interesting. And this is all taking place before the dinosaurs or even just, you know, a sort of twinkle in nature's eye. I mean, this is a long time before the time of dinosaurs that our ancestors, these synapsids and therapsids, begin to do these incredible things, become mega herbivores. Like I said, you know, there's these creatures like Stemmenosuchus is one of them I talk about in the book. And it's about 3 meters long. And it's built like a nightclub bouncer. I mean, this is a massive, chunky creature, you know, chomping its way through the vegetation of the Permian Earth. It's really incredible time period to look at and massively underrepresented in popular culture and in books about the past.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing that when we actually look at, and I'm gleaning all of this just from this lovely schematic at the beginning, but when we, so first I had this thought in my mind, like, oh my gosh, I think about the biodiversity of mammals on the planet today, and they're so wide, you know, ranging from, like even in this, in here you show sort of like, yes, woolly mammoth that is extinct, but let's say like a modern elephant and a kangaroo and a platypus and my dog, and you know, you think about all these different mammals and how they look so different. And then I'm looking at sort of that period between the extinction event that happened during the era of the dinosaurs and now, and like pretty much all the mammals look like mice. Like everything just kind of looks like a rat. And I was like, oh, why are they not very... But then, of course, if you look back before that, there is this like incredible diversity, even of the fossils that we have access to. And we know that's a sampling problem. We have a bias because we only know what we found. There's way more than what we found. But even there, we're seeing pretty incredible diversity in form and in kind of specialization. Why is it that right after the massive mass extinction event, everything kind of looked like a rat. Is that a terrible oversimplification?
No, but you're kind of, you know, broad brush terms, you're kind of right. I mean, when it comes to the synapses as a lineage, they have this really interesting pattern of, as you say, being mega diverse and interesting, doing these incredible things, having saber teeth, being herbivores, being diggers, being climbers. But there's this, the largest mass extinction of all time is not actually the one that wiped out the non-bird dinosaurs. It's the one that kind of cleared the path for them. So it's at the end of the Permian, about 252 million years ago, caused by super volcanoes erupting in what's now Siberia. I mean, erupting so much lava, it would, you know, cover a sort of area the size of China, miles deep. I mean, this is a really horrendous event. And it wiped out not just these incredible mammal predecessors that I just mentioned, but lots of groups. And it sort of reset the race, as it were. And it just happened to be that it was the reptiles that kind of got there first. There doesn't appear to be any particular reason for that. And I suspect it's just the luck of the draw. It usually is with these kinds of things, the luck of the draw as to who just happened to get there first. So really the reptiles did become large and begin to do all these interesting things, including some of them becoming dinosaurs, flying reptiles, marine reptiles. And as you say, the mammals all remain quite small and superficially, yeah, kind of like small mammals today. But even within that, it was for a long time thought that they were all just mice and nothing else. But even,
right, because that's how they look from the outside.
Exactly. Like, they were also only known from just a few teeth, a jaw here and there, and nothing really else. But in the last 20 years, we've begun to realize that although they were small, I think the very largest was really not much larger than I was going to say a badger, but I don't know if you've got badgers in North America.
Like, we do.
Yeah, you do.
Okay, cool. We know the badger.
Okay, cool. I guess a raccoon.
Not the honey badger, but a badger. Yes,
yeah, exactly. A raccoon would be another example. They didn't get much bigger than that, but we're now realizing we're finding much more complete fossils, particularly coming from China. And because we have the whole body of these fossils rather than just teeth, we're realizing that they're actually very, very diverse. They just are smaller. So we've got climbers, we've got Jurassic moles, you know, we've got specialist diggers, we've got swimmers. They're doing all the stuff that mammals of the same body size do today, but they're doing it in the time of dinosaurs. They just don't get larger. Until, of course, that niche space opens up after the mass extinction 66 million years ago. And that leads to the lineages we know today. But you know, part of the book, part of the reason I wrote the book is that there are so many books that cover the last 66 million years. I mean, every year there's another book on the so-called origin of mammals, and they always start with the loss of the non-bird dinosaurs. And as I say, that's not the beginning. There's just this huge story before that, not just for the animals, but for the people who study them and what these animals tell us about modern mammals and the world that we live in now.
And so let's go back. We discussed this idea that it is a little bit arbitrary sort of determining at which point you want to begin the journey, because we could go all the way back.
Oh, yeah.
But tell me, in terms of sort of your research, the work that you do, where you felt the most confident to say, okay, this is a comfortable origin point to begin this story.
So synapsids, the group that we're talking about that mammals also belong to, they're are a number of features in their skeleton that basically are the ones that scientists have decided are the telling features that an animal belongs to that group. And of course, there's multiple ones, but there's a really obvious one that you can see just in the skull. And that is the number of, they're called fenestra, but that just means holes, the number of holes in the skull behind the eye. So in really early four-limbed backboned animals, tetrapods, we start to see that there's a difference in the skulls. And some of these animals have two holes behind the eye, and those are the ones that then include reptiles later. And then some of them only have one hole, and those are the ones that includes us, the mammal lineage. The reason why they have this difference is not entirely clear. It could be something to do with muscle attachments and the way that they can move their jaws. It's not really clear, but that is the sort of telltale feature. I mean, it really is just this single hole, and you can actually feel it in your own skull, but it's not a hole in the same way as it is in your earliest ancestors. But if you put your fingertips just like behind or, you know, beside your eye, you'll see there's a ridge beside your eye on the outside. And then there's a little like indent behind the eye, and you can kind of push your finger into it. And if you open and close your jaw, you'll feel the muscles inside that hole just moving around. That's actually that hole. That's that single hole in your skull. It's still there.
Your temples?
Yeah. So if you put your finger to like the outside edge of your eye and you feel there's a bone, and then put your fingers to the side of your head, just at the same bit in the temple on either side, there's like a little hollow. That's it. That is the hole. And that's what makes you a synapsid, is that single hole. So it's still a telltale feature of our group. So really that's part of the reason that I also chose that to be the beginning of the book, is because that is the feature that we use to define our whole lineage and all the animals that are more closely related to us than anything else.
Oh, that's fascinating. And of course, early synapsids don't look the way that modern mammals look, but we retained certain features. So there is, we know based on the number of fossils that we have, and we know based on the genetics that we've done, that kind of there is a continuous, I don't want to say continuous because it's never continuous, but there is a slow and steady change that ultimately does, we are a terminating branch of that of that group. I guess that's a good way to put it. Like when it comes to an evolutionary, I don't like the linear stuff. It's we're a tree, right? It's like a branching
exactly.
tree.
Yeah, exactly. I think it's interesting you said terminating branch. I hope we're not a terminating branch. I hope
oh my gosh.
I hope we keep going.
You're so right. That's horrible. I don't know, man, though, based on like where things are in the world right now. It's like, oof. How funny. But yeah, it's true. If we draw our tree up till now, we don't know what the future holds. So we're sort of a in progress brand on that tree. But there are, of course, so many trees that came up next to us, that came up before us, that just ended because, you know, the last of the organisms went extinct.
Exactly. And this is one of the things when you begin to look at the fossil record, you become kind of astonished by how many groups there were before us. And I mean, in the time of dinosaurs, that's the time, my kind of pet time period, because that's when a lot of the fossils I study myself come from the Jurassic. So I'm very into that time period. But our more direct ancestors, the ancestors of what we call Therian mammals, like ourselves, they were the quintessential boring little rats of the Cretaceous. It was actually all these other lineages that had risen before them, these sort of sister groups, these cousins, they were all the ones that were doing interesting stuff. But when the asteroid hit, it was many of those groups that didn't survive. And it was probably the removal of them rather than the removal of the dinosaurs that cleared the space for mammals to get going and diversify into the modern groups we see now.
Yeah, it's interesting. When we think about reptiles today, clearly there's a lot of diversity, but I almost think that they were similar to the way we think about mammals post-impact because, you know, there's like a Komodo dragon. There's a couple like big guys, but nothing's huge. Everything's sort of similar inside. I guess crocodiles are pretty big. But yeah. But when you really think about it, reptiles sort of have a lot of stuff in common. And they're sort of, I mean, they have a big niche and they, you know, they're everywhere on the planet. But if an alien from the future were to look at the fossil record, they might be like drawing them the same way we draw these like rats, you know?
Yeah.
Like the mammals.
Yeah. I mean, this is something I hope people take away from the book as well, is that, you know, I have this part in one of the chapters where I talk about language, because I think there's a really unfortunate patriarchal, militaristic legacy in language about evolution, and particularly in paleontology. We're constantly talking about the reign of different creatures and, you know, the rise and fall, like their empires or something like that. And things are always either losing or winning. It's all so polarized and so, you know, so competitive. It's
also like developed by men.
And still generally populated by them and written about by them as well. So what I really consciously did throughout the book was try to avoid using those terms and try to think about it more. Like I hope people can take away from the book the fact that this is not really how evolution works, because it's turn-based. You know, to begin with, it was our lineage that were doing a lot of these like large-bodied things and being herbivores and stuff like that. And then it swapped over, and then it was the reptiles doing it for 160 million years, and now it's swapped over again, and it's mammals. And even then, okay, so mammals include the largest creatures, but actually we've not got the most species. There's only about 8,500 mammals, you know, depending on whose estimate you look at. But I mean, there's at least 12 to 18,000 species of bird. So way more than there are of mammals. And then, of course, look at insects. I mean, there are literally millions of species. So, you know, I think it's really good if we challenge our assumptions and the way that we look at stuff and try and think about it from the perspective of, you know, some other creature. Or as you say, of aliens coming to this planet, what would they think was actually the most successful creature in the planet? They might not think it's mammals.
Yeah, especially if they came prior to human beings just completely, you know, taking over and becoming an invasive species.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, now they might think it's mammals if they know that humans are mammals, because we have been too successful in our ability to kind of reproduce and overrun our niche, for sure. But you're right. It's so interesting to think about the fact that sort of everything has a bias. The way that we often like to think about science as though there's a purity to it because it is self-correcting and because of the peer review process and because of the kind of the concept of individuals coming together and reproducing each other's work and confirming or disconfirming, but it's still done by people. And for the vast majority of the history of science, it was done by like gentlemen, you know, like it was done by like men of certain means,
exactly.
And you know, as white men of certain means. And of course that really did codify a very intense bias. And of course there are other forms of bias, like the fact that we only know what we know based on the specimens we've collected.
Yeah, absolutely.
We have to assume there's way more than we've ever collected, way more than ever fossilized. You know, there's stuff that we will never, ever know about because it never left a trace.
Well, there's all the stuff buried under the ice in Antarctica. I mean, there's, you know, that Antarctica virtually had no ice for a huge portion of the history of life on Earth. So, I mean, there should be a massive fossil record there, but we can't get to virtually any of it because it's all under there. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. There's just way more that we don't know than we ever do know. And we definitely bring a lot of biases. I'm sure I have as well to the book. You know, we all do that. We can't avoid it.
And of course, there are things that we will never know simply because there's no evidence. Like evidence is only, it's forensic in nature. Paleontologic evidence is forensic. And so it's sort of like if something died and didn't fossilize because of where it was in the ecosystem, because of the weather patterns, because of the ground, because of whatever, we'll never know about it. It just will be as if, you know, it didn't happen, but it did happen. We have to assume that stuff was happening, even if we don't have records.
Yeah, like, well, exactly. Exactly. And I think another interesting bias that we do look at a lot in paleontology is people are very fascinated by things being bigger, fiercer, you know, super predators get lots and lots of attention. And people have a tendency to think that if something was small, if it didn't have massive teeth or run really fast or do something that, you know, is a superlative of some kind, that actually means that it wasn't successful somehow.
But which is ridiculous. Oh, because so... like look at the rat, look at the cockroach, like look at these things that have just like had some staying power.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you said there earlier that, you know, all these things in the time of dinosaurs look like little mice. And actually, it's a really interesting observation, because we can trace that back to the origin of basically creatures that are pretty much mammals. So the mammalia forms, which we're also part of, that happens around about 200 million years ago, that our common ancestors, basically all of them, become very small. They telescope down. And for this has always been portrayed as like mammals were losers. They were, you know, the dinosaurs were incredible and the mammals were just hiding and cowering and being eaten by dinosaurs all the time. But actually, if you think about it, you know, the fact that they became so small and they really kind of perfected it, and it was obviously such a good way of life, that there's still the vast majority of mammal species today, of that 8,500 I was talking about, 2/3 of them are rodents. Because,
right.
Because actually, being a tiny little scuttly thing that can eat lots of different kinds of food, live in lots of environments, is really adaptable. That is a fantastic way to make a living. So actually, it's really, really successful. It just isn't very big.
Right. And we do have this like sort of, even the terms we use, like charismatic. Mm-hmm. We use the word charismatic all the time. Charismatic megafauna. Mm-hmm. And I even have friends who worked in the Amazon rainforest, who studied these large species of trees that drop fruit that is no longer edible to any modern extant species. So they're sort of the ghosts of the rainforest, because it's really cool. Like, they help us understand what species were actually dispersing their seeds back in the day.
That's so sad somehow, isn't it?
I know, it's really sad. But they often refer to these species as charismatic mega flora, which I think is quite fun and cheeky. But that word charismatic, it's like, oh, it's big and it's like complex and cool. And so therefore more interesting and important to us.
Mm.
That's not cool.
Yeah. And the more that you kind of open your mind to thinking about different ideas of what actually is interesting and what is actually successful, you begin to just look at the evolution of life quite differently. And people who work on invertebrates, of course, they already know this, because they're working on stuff that lots of people are not interested in. I don't mean that in a mean way. I mean, it's just true. Lots of people, they want to hear about T-Rex. They don't want to hear about trilobites. But actually, they already have noticed this, that these creatures, once you open your mind to them, they tell you so much more, and they're actually incredibly interesting and informative. And in the case of mammals, it turns out that them becoming so tiny at this time, 200 million years ago, actually it appears from what we are now discovering that it led to a lot of the physiological and anatomical changes that then basically unlocked what we now know as modern mammals. It changed the arrangement of their jaw joints. It changed their physiology. And if they hadn't become so small at this point, we probably wouldn't have mammals as we know them today. So it was a great time period, really, for mammals. There just happened to be a bunch of dinosaurs around.
And, you know, when we think about mammal, the word mammal, I mean, I go to like mammary, and I go to, you know, sometimes people think about fur, but that doesn't really hold up. And sometimes people think about, you know, placental, but they're non-placental. And so it's like, what are we, again, this concept we've been discussing about language and how precise it is, and taxonomy and these arbitrary points in time, you know, true, I guess, mammals, what we would refer to as mammals, is this just a construct? Is it that at a certain point in time, somebody said, I shall call this mammal, which means that anything we found from before that, we had to go, oh, well, crap, now that's mammaliform and mammalomorph, because mammals already got taken. I mean, is it really that story?
Kind of. actually, I'm really glad you picked up on the mammal, the word mammal. It's got a very interesting history. It's got actually quite a sort of, there's a real feminist story here. So mammals as a group are in fact, the only taxonomic group, someone can correct me, I'm sure, that is named for a feature that only half or thereabouts of the creatures that he's talking about have, as you say.
Right, and only the female have.
Only the females have mammary glands.
I get it.
So actually that's really quite interesting and very unusual. And there's a broader historical context for when this term was coined, because at the time there was a drive to encourage women to breastfeed their own babies and not to use wet nurses. So there was actually social, politically, a lot of focus on the breast and on the goodness of milk and of feeding your young. So it's really interesting that you know, mammal was chosen as the word for our group, because as you say, it could have been something else. It could have been something to do with warm-bloodedness or the holes in the head. It could have been, we could have been the fenestrals or something like that. I don't know.
The unifenestrals as opposed to the bifenestral. That feels very scientific. Or even with regards to reproduction, that there's not like a womb kind of consideration. I don't know. It does feel very kind of arbitrary, but none of it's arbitrary when you look at it at that cross-section of time, because we are people and we don't occur in a vacuum and there are social influences.
So it's very, very interesting term. I mean, if you're wanting to know about the more like technical term, like how do I look at the fossil record and say, I crown thee a mammal, I'm telling you, you're not quite a mammal yet. Well, again, it's a bunch of sort of technical things about the anatomy of an animal that we've basically decided that's the point that we're going to say these things are mammals and these things are not quite. One of the real focuses for mammals is in their jaw joint. So it's I explain it better in the book than I'm probably going to explain it right now. But basically, in the earlier mammal predecessors, there are multiple bones that make up the lower jaw. So we've obviously got just one big bone now, and that's, you know, our mandible, our jawbone. But in the past, our ancestors had multiple bones, and reptiles still do have multiple bones in their jaws. And through the course of the evolution of synapsids, the bones at the back of the jaw became smaller and smaller, and this one bone, the dentary, became larger and took up basically the whole of our bottom jaw. And eventually, at the very earliest sort of mammalia forms, we begin to see that we have just this single joint between the dentary and between one of the bones in the skull. And then when it comes to mammalians, we begin to see that the remnants of these little bones at the back of the jaw have become completely detached from the jaw and actually incorporated into our ears. And so the smallest bones in our bodies, in mammal bodies, are the ear bones, the malleus, incus and stapes. And the stapes is something that all tetrapods have, but the malleus and incus only mammals have, and they're actually what's left of the rest of the bones in your jaw.
So that's freaking crazy.
Isn't it absolutely mental?
Wow. And they've become, I love it too, because they've also become so specialized. Like they serve a completely different purpose now.
Absolutely. They basically amplify sound. And this is why we have bats that can hear ultra high frequencies. And then things like, you know, whales, elephants can hear these really low frequencies. We are very audio sort of centric creature compared to most other tetrapods. They don't hear as well as we do. They only have a stapes, and they have a completely different structure inside, in terms of their hearing and their ears. We're actually very sensory in general, because if you think about, again, you know, whiskers, fur, this is all about touching and sensing the world. We also have a really heightened sense of smell, much more than most other tetrapods, and all of this can kind of be traced back to, you know, way beyond the mammals that came after the non-bird dinosaurs and the extinction. Right back, we begin to see this in the much earlier lineages of mammal predecessors, that they start to have fur and whiskers, so they're obviously sensing their world. And of course, without fur and whiskers, mammals wouldn't be mammals, would they?
Right. And it's so funny that, you know, I'm going to this place in my mind where you have to almost resist the instinct to say, but why? Why would it evolve that? Why would it do that? And you have to kind of stop yourself and go, no. It's not about now. It's about whatever pressure was on the organism at that time. which is always shifting. The world, the climate, the you know, food sources, the reproductive, you know, advantages, always shifting. So just whatever they happen to have some random trait and it happened to work well for them, they're going to keep doing it and keep doing it. And it's, I think we get in this trap where we think about what is today as being a goal. But evolution's not goal-oriented. It just happens based on the environment.
Exactly. And we do this all the time with our own lives, you know, like you end up, you know, meeting your partner and getting married, and then you look back and you say, oh, it's because I happened to be in that one place at that one time. If I hadn't been there, I would never have met you. It was all fate. It was all meant to be. But actually, you know, I guess maybe I'm just showing that I'm perhaps not as romantic as I ought to be. It could have been someone else. You could have bumped into anyone. You happened to just...
And you wouldn't have known the difference.
Exactly.
Because you never would have met them.
And you'd be telling the same story about the other person you were with, because this is what evolution is like. As you say, there's definitely no end goal. There's just this endless variation, and then there's, you know, whittling down depending on how the climate changes, or, you know, something changes around them, and some creatures are just going to do better than others. And so one of the really interesting things I think about what we've been talking about milk and about whiskers is that we're starting to look at the fossil record using synchrotron and CT scanning. So this is X-ray scanning, basically, of fossils. And it's telling us that there's a possibility, there's a link between those two things as well, that the ability to grow fur and whiskers might actually be linked to the production of milk, because they come from the same structures in the skin. And there are then like telltale things in the skeleton, the way the skeleton changes as well. So we're still learning new things about how all of these different traits emerge. But of course, one of them didn't emerge in order for the other one to emerge. It's just knock-on effects and happenstance and, you know, different creatures doing better.
Oh, that's fascinating to think about that link. It reminds me a little bit. I connect things weirdly in my brain, so bear with me sometimes when I'm like, oh, I think I have a metaphor. But this isn't even really a metaphor, but when we think about phylogenetics and sort of the way that certain phenotypes arise, I always get taken back to the kind of classic Russian fox experiment, where we sort of forced evolution with these foxes by domesticating them in a very like specific and intentional way. And what we found as the foxes began, as the sort of foxes that interacted well with people. And if you've never read about this, I highly recommend it. I also did an episode with a man who wrote a book about this and kind of went and talked to the researchers at great length. But what they found is that as the foxes, they chose the foxes that were the nicest to people. It had nothing to do with how they treated each other, but that were like the most kind of warm towards people. And they bred them and bred them and bred them. And they chose the foxes that were the most aggressive towards people and bred them and bred them and bred them. And they ended up with these like super aggressive foxes that were like wilder than wild. And then these foxes that basically could be your pet, and except that they smell really bad and they still pee themselves all the time. So they're not great pets, but they're really sweet. And what they found was, this is the part that fascinated me the most, their tails started to wag, their ears started to droop, and they developed spots just like dogs. So clearly it's in the DNA in a similar region, the traits that they were selecting for. And so these were come along traits.
Isn't it odd? Isn't it really, really strange?
Right?
I mean, yeah. I have heard that people postulate that humans have also domesticated themselves, and that some of the traits that we have might be our own self-domestication, which I find really quite a fascinating idea too. But you're quite right. And trying to understand, particularly if you're looking at fossils, which of course you can't study the DNA directly, trying to understand how one trait or one characteristic is related to another, let alone in animals whose DNA we can study, it's really, really complex and really unexpected. I mean, who would have thought that domestication would for some reason make waggy tails and floppy ears? But those things do seem to go together.
Spots in the, like, coloration spots in the fur and floppy ears are somewhere in a similar genetic, literal similar place on the karyotype. Like the actual chromosome must carry those in similar places. And oh, the other thing that was so fascinating was also behaviors come along with that, because dogs, which are, as we know, like long domesticated wolves, they can follow a human finger. You can point and a dog will look at where you're pointing. Foxes don't do this in nature, but domestic foxes do.
Mm. Yeah, that's quite fascinating. Another thing that it can be sometimes is a relaxing of selection. And this, so, you know, for obviously, if you're a fox in the wild, you do not want to be black and white spotty because you're going to stand out. But maybe naturally, different variation in coats, you know, in their actual fur pattern might have occurred, but it would be weeded out. Because they wouldn't survive very well.
Suppressed by evolution.
Exactly. And I mean, this is again something that you can see in the fossil record, and mammals are a great example, because we're talking about size again. That's probably why a lot of them remain small, because they just weren't getting that chance. And of course, the moment that the constraints are taken away, there's space to change and for natural amounts of mutation, things that would be happening anyway, but those creatures just wouldn't be surviving because they just would be too big, for example. They would be competing with something else. They have the space. They have the space to get incrementally larger, but of course, it seems very slow to us in human years. But over the course of millions of years, it can happen really, really quickly.
Well, and this is a reason that I kind of take real ethical umbrage with the conversation around de-extinction, which very often, for some reason, centers on the woolly mammoth, likely because of the permafrost and because we have some, at least, fragments of DNA which have been preserved, and we have modern elephants, and there could be a way to kind of splice it in and have a surrogate, and you know, all the complicated aspects of it seem like they could be slightly more solvable with a woolly mammoth, but where is this thing going to, like, it doesn't have an ecological niche. And it really hurts my heart to think about bringing back something that, yes, of course, humans likely played a big role in its extinction, but like, we're hardly able to carry modern elephants. Like, we're poaching them to death and we're deforesting them to death. And it just like hurts my heart to think about bringing back a species and leaving it, like, literally, quote, to the wolves, because those evolutionary pressures, those ecological constraints, they're not the way they were back when they, you know, lived. I almost said ruled. Oh, God.
It's so easy to do.
We can't think about a species without thinking about its environment, can we?
I agree with you. And particularly for things like passenger pigeons, dodos, stuff like that. I mean, I would just say to the people who want to bring them back, I would say, well, hang on a minute. What's changed since they became extinct, since we made them extinct? And in most cases, nothing's actually changed. So if we bring them back, we're just bringing them back to exactly the same problem that they would have had before.
Oh, no, it's worse.
Arguably. Also, if it was something like a woolly mammoth, would we just relegate it to living in the equivalent of a zoo for the rest of its life?
We would. I mean, that's the only thing. We would bring it back to prove that we could, and then it would be an oddity. It would be a creature behind bars that people would pay money to look at, which is so sad.
Mm. Yeah, there's the culminating chapter in Beasts Before Us is actually trying to look to the future for mammals, obviously for humans as well, but thinking about how mammals are going to respond to us, to the world that we're kind of making, and to climate change. I think we generally 99.9% of people are realizing that it's going to happen. To what degree we have our climate changes, that's just the only unknown factor. But there are certain things we're already beginning to see and that we can predict based on the fossil record. And one of them is that big things don't do well in mass extinctions. If you look at every mass extinction, all the large animals and all the really specialized ones, in other words, the really interesting ones that are doing these fantastic, unusual things, they are the ones that don't tend to do so well. The things that will do well are the things that have always done well. Small stuff, rat-like creatures. You know, rats actually will probably do quite well. But also they'll begin probably to change their behaviours. So if it gets, generally speaking, over the planet, warmer, probably with more arid, you know, lots of environments will become very arid, very desertified. Creatures are likely to, mammals, I should say specifically, are likely to become more nocturnal. And they have that adaptability that, you know, a lot of mammals are already, depending on where they live, they come out more during the daytime or more during the evening or night, depending on climatic conditions. So if it gets warmer and drier, you're likely to see them shifting into a much more nocturnal life. And yeah, so things like that. I mean, I've got to sort of, it's not, obviously it's difficult to predict what's going to happen, but we can sort of make some general assumptions about the sort of path for a lot of creatures going forwards. And of course, the other thing is that a huge number of the animals alive on our planet, the non-human mammals, are actually farm animals. You know, yeah, virtually, you know, proportionally speaking, like, you know, if you look at the statistics, there's virtually no wild animals left by comparison. We have millions and millions and millions of farm animals. And, you know, I love them. I love cows. I love sheep. I've got nothing against them. But clearly, you know, we're talking about a really impoverished future if those are the creatures that we're, you know, going to mostly be seeing around us rather than the incredible diversity that's taken so long to develop since whichever time point you want to pick, whether it's 66 million years ago or 300 million years ago.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and it's as you mentioned, it's just heartbreaking to think about those numbers of organisms that we have kind of utilized, I guess, for human purposes and said, okay, you matter and you're a pest, or you are a beast of burden and you are just a beast that, you know, kills my livestock, so I'm going to kill you. And I mean, I don't know, the statistic that really like blows my mind, and I shouldn't say we all, because some people realize this after watching Tiger King, is that there are literally more cats, big cats, tigers specifically, in captivity than there are in the wild. There are thought to be 3,900 wild tigers left in the entire world. And there are more than 5,000 tigers in captivity in the United States alone. It's horrifying. And this is like, you know, I'm curious how you hold in your mind, as a paleontologist and as somebody who's very interested both in the lineage and origin of the species that exist today, but also the extant species that are actively, you know, evolving right now, how you hold in your mind the fascination of the work and the sort of awe and wonder of the science, and at the same time, this just devastating understanding of the state of our ecologic balance or lack thereof, you know, because it must be a stark contrast that kind of wakes you up sometimes when you remember what we're dealing with.
You're absolutely right. I think you've hit the nail on the head with everything you've just said there. I think so when I actually ended up becoming a paleontologist, having taken a course in environmental science, not paleontology at all, because I thought I wanted to enter conservation. And clearly that's a very, very worthwhile thing to do. But I did struggle with the state of things and how difficult it is to maintain positivity. But when I actually did one class in climate change where we looked at paleoclimates, and I really have to say I found a kind of consolation in deep time, a consolation in the geological record, and as well as a fascination for things in the past that I just, I think this is probably one of the reasons I ended up switching, is that it is very difficult. You do have to have a resilience to kind of look at the state of things and figure out a way through. I mean, I'm generally a positive thinker. I think that we can make our way through. But for me, I ended up, I guess, hiding in the past where everything's already dead, so I don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, I love that so much.
I don't have to try and save them because they're already dead and they've been dead for ages.
It's like, that's just, so I study psychology now. I was doing neuroscience, but I went back to school for clinical psychology. So I work as a therapist and, you know, I'm working on my PhD now, close to being done. But my orientation is existential. And so I read a lot of like existential literature and see how it sort of coalesces with modern psychotherapy. And there's just something that you said that's so like beautifully existential and absurdist. And I just love it. Like, it's like dark, but hilarious and like so real and raw. It's just a classic example of kind of like the human condition for, I don't know, Nietzsche or Kierkegaard or Camus or something. I just love that so much. I have to ask because I close all of my episodes by asking these two big questions, and we'll do that in just one second. But before we do, we didn't really we opened talking about it, but I'd love to hear at the end also give a shout out to the new book that you wrote, which comes out this July. So Beast Before Us is available right now. You can get it at any bookstore here in the US. But the new book you wrote, The Earth, A Biography of Life, is available in the US in July. Is it already available in the UK?
It is. Yeah, it just came out a week or two ago. Yeah. So this is quite a different book, but in a way I can sort of begin, as I'm talking to you, see parallels between the two. Obviously, so I'm trying to tell the story of really the Earth since it sort of formed, you know, from dust in the solar system right the way through to the present day. But that is such an enormous story to tell. So the way that I've done it is by selecting a number of organisms that in themselves are obviously inherently interesting, but actually they're really just windows through which we can look at the wider workings of the planet and the way that everything is interconnected, but also the sort of things like the beginnings of particular lineages that have then shaped ecosystems, or behaviors that, you know, like the first flight, for example, or the first creatures that have come out of the water and walk on land. So there's a mixture of different things in there, and it's written in a way that you can read it from start to finish and get this sort of overriding narrative, or you can dip in and out and take sort of bite-sized chunks, and hopefully every chapter is quite digestible and quite fun to read, I hope, as well.
Oh, I love that so much. Oh, I love that. All right. So, Elsa. So, I always close my episodes by asking my guests the same two questions. So, they're sort of like big picture questions. And we may have actually touched on your answers to them. And if that's the case, that's fine. You can just say, yes, we already talked about this. This is what I think. But if not, maybe there's something new. We'll see. So are you ready for these sort of deeper kind of big picture questions?
Yeah, lay them on me. What are they?
All right. take all the time you need.
I'm rubbing my hands together and waiting for these. Okay.
Love it. So when you think about the future, and that could be in whatever context is relevant to you. So it could be, you know, the future of these organisms that we've been discussing, the future of the planet. It could be the future of your work, the future of your family, you personally. Really, like, take it in whatever kind of sliver contextually you want to. The first thing is, what is the thing that is keeping you up the most at night? The thing where you're like finding that you're the most concerned, maybe venturing from worried to pessimistic, even to cynical. You know, what really is keeping you up? And then on the flip side of that, to end on a more positive note, where do you find your optimism, your hope? What are you kind of genuinely and authentically looking forward to?
Those are great questions. I mean, yeah, we have kind of touched on, I think, the most obvious one, which is, of course, the state of the world. So I'm going to not say that as the thing that keeps me up. Although it obviously does. Any person who's aware of what's going on must be kept up at least occasionally by that. I think I'll maybe take it to a more family level because that's perhaps the other thing that keeps me up at night. I mean, not long before writing Beast Before Us, I actually lost my dad, and it made me realize how short a time we have with each other. I think as a paleontologist, we are always dealing with, like, you know, if we say something is a million years ago, paleontologists are like, oh, so that was really recent then, you know, because we're dealing in hundreds of millions of years. You can sometimes forget how quickly an individual lifetime passes. So one of the things that worries me, I think, is not having enough time to properly spend the time you want with your loved ones, with your family, your friends, and the people who are important to you. And it definitely has changed the way that I live my life and what I prioritize in my life. So yeah, that's one of my worries, is that, yeah, that I'm not, I don't have enough time to spend that I want to with the people I want to. And I think probably a lot of people have that worry. Yeah, we can get so focused as well, I think, on our careers and things that we forget. What gives me hope, though, I think I'll go back to the geological answer, because it's true. One of the things I love about studying things in deep time is that I guess I feel like very allied to the bigger picture of the Earth. And this is part of why I wrote the second book about the Earth, because I feel like she herself, I mean, she shrugs off species here, there and everywhere, makes new ones, you know. Like, basically what I'm saying is, in the bigger scheme of things, lineages come and go, there's mass extinctions, then everything radiates again, and then they're wiped out again. And life always continues. And I know that ultimately, in billions of years, it won't. But I find there's something deeply comforting about seeing that even at its absolute worst, you know, when the volcanoes were erupting, you know, millions of tons of lava, something always survives. And I think in the face of anthropogenic climate change, that does give me hope, because although I would like it to be that we save as much as possible and we don't lose that diversity, I think if everything goes totally wrong, disaster movie levels of wrong, and humans don't make it, in a way, that's okay, because something will. The next civilization might be formed by, I don't know, some other lineage, but there's something kind of weirdly comforting about that.
I agree. Yeah, it's almost like it helps us with our hubris too, because I think, you know, obviously climate change is the most devastating crisis sort of facing our time, that the climate crisis which we created, it's like we're taking ourselves down, and sadly we're also taking down probably thousands of species with us, if not hundreds of thousands. But you're right, like, we're not going to destroy the Earth. We don't have that capability. We're going to destroy ourselves. We're going to destroy the Earth's capacity to carry us, but something else is going to be okay. Like, the cockroaches shall rise.
Yeah, exactly. The cockroach civilization will be having a podcast where they're talking about, like, this weird lot of mammals that basically destroyed themselves. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's actually a very dark sort of comfort, but I do find it genuinely comforting, because, you know, life goes on. Life does survive eventually. You know, things will become diverse again and recover. I would really hope that we our descendants will be there to see it.
Agree wholeheartedly. Well, everybody, the books are Beasts Before Us, The Untold Story of Mammal Origins and Evolution, and then the new book, The Earth, Biography of Life by Elsa Panciroli. Did I do that okay?
You did, Panciroli. Yeah.
Added a little flair to it.
Yeah.
Elsa, thank you so much for joining us today. It was just such a blast chatting with you and learning from you, and celebrating the diversity of mammals, not just today, but throughout this long, long history.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I should say that, like, I absolutely love this podcast. So I'm really honored and excited to have been able to come on and speak to you and your listeners.
Oh, that makes me so happy. Love it, love it. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.